It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Marie Tomchick, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you both doing?
Oh, you don't want to know, but we're fine.
Good.
I am, anyway.
Good. I haven't had a wardrobe malfunction yet, so.
And we're counting on that all the way through the half hour.
All right. Yeah, well, as long as you keep your hands to yourself, John.
Yeah. Better. And radio is kind of an ineffective place for wardrobe malfunctions anyway.
That's true. So true.
That's true.
All right. Well, we got a lot of stuff to cover in a short period of time. We should mention today's a big day for Washington State.
Yeah, Washington and Michigan are the two states with Democratic caucuses today. Washington's Republican caucus, for those people inclined to participate in the Republican caucus, isn't until next month. But for folks who want to weigh in on the Democratic caucuses, and it is expected to be in record numbers today, they start at 10 o'clock. It's a short process. It only lasts about an hour. And if you need to find out, or you want to find out, or you can't figure out where to go or where in your local precinct to go, the website that has that information, regardless of county, it's a statewide website, is wademocrats.org. So it's wa-democrats.org. And that will list, you go in and click in the county that you're in, and then the precinct number if you know it, and
the precinct number will be on your voter registration card.
Exactly. And one of the things we were talking about before we came on air this morning also, and just to remind folks that the caucuses are not merely a place to go and ratify John Kerry. I mean, he's clearly the front runner right now. He'll probably do quite well today, but they're also a place, particularly because it's not a secret ballot. It's a very public demonstration of who you prefer. That I have a real problem with Kerry, not based on Kerry himself, but the whole idea that he won the Iowa caucuses, and that's pretty much determined the outcome of every vote that's happened since then, is that he's been anointed this media front runner, and people have been sort of flocking to the front runner. This is an exercise in which people can vote for their conscience, vote for the candidate who most closely reflects their own views. And this is also a process by which people can introduce resolutions, which is routinely done in caucuses and is being done in an organized way again by some groups this year. But those resolutions then turn around and go to the state convention and then to the national convention as a way of influencing the party platform also this year as well, and an expression of what people care about and the issues that motivate them. So 10 o'clock, www.wa-democrats.org is where you go on the web to find out where to go.
And it's recommended that people get there a half hour early, so because there's going to be lots of people coming in. They're expecting a lot of people, so
yeah,
getting there early helps. All right, well, let's move along. It was the White House revealed something this week, and
it wasn't a wardrobe malfunction.
No, it was
it
was a calculator malfunction. No, wardrobe malfunction at the White House would be something terrifying to behold.
We're talking about the budget.
Yeah, and it was a calculator malfunction. Yeah, this budget, and I think Maria and I are both going to take our pot shots at this thing because one person doesn't really do it justice. I've probably seen in the last couple of days, the budget, the federal budget's a huge document. It takes some time to go through. I've probably seen six or seven different articles that go through and methodically detail ways in which the budget is fundamentally dishonest, fundamentally deceptive, does not include numbers that it should, has fallacious assumptions, has areas on which it is just plain inaccurate.
And now questionable assumptions in the budget process are common, like if you assume that the economy is going to grow at a faster rate, but that's not what they're talking about here.
They do that in here too, but this is something beyond that as well.
Yeah, they're talking about just outright false assumptions.
Yeah, and the remarkable thing is that I've seen all of these different articles, and none of them overlap. They all have found different little pieces of the budget in which this is true. So that, for example, you have line items for programs where They say, you know, in each budget item, each program, you're supposed to have what the cost is to the government, and then what revenue it might bring in to offset it. And under the revenue line, it's like Congress will at a future date determine cost offsetting measures. So just like that, you zero out the line item. It costs absolutely nothing.
Assuming that Congress is going to cut something somewhere else.
Yeah, and the idea that Congress ever puts in cuts during a budget is ridiculous also.
Particularly budgets, during an election year.
Yes, yeah, budgets grow. They don't shrink during the legislative process. You know, George Bush has been getting an awful lot of heat in the last couple of months, particularly from conservatives and from fiscal conservatives over the size of spending growth during his administration, and not just military and homeland security, which is where you would expect it, but all throughout the administration. It's been very stacked. It's been, you know, severe cuts, in fact, in a lot of places, in areas like, oh, you know, enforcement of regulations that might adversely affect Republican donors, that kind of thing, social services for the needy. But if you're talking about corporate welfare in particular, if you're and the income that isn't coming in terms of in terms of the tax cuts that have had a tremendous effect on the budget, these sorts of moving in opposite direction, more spending and less revenue, is what has produced such a huge deficit. And that has happened again this year, despite its being marketed as slowing the growth and moving toward helping to erase the budget deficit. That's the first and biggest lie of this budget, is that it is compounding the problem that the Bush administration has created over the past 3 years of burdening our grandchildren's grandchildren with debt. And it's doing so in a very political, very lopsided way for a lot of very questionable programs, many of which have been instituted by executive order rather than through Congress, like all of the various faith-based initiative programs, a lot of the homeland security stuff. There's just a lot of ways in which this is a fundamentally deceptive budget. It's really, as budgets go, it's really a remarkable document. This is not something that has a lot of precedent in terms of what a White House has done with a budget process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would add to that, too, that the single biggest item in the budget that is not written into the numbers
Afghanistan and Iraq.
Exactly.
Yep.
And analysts have said that they think that's going to cost an additional $50 billion this coming year. However, that assumes that the Bush administration is going to be able to follow the timeline that they've laid out for turning over sovereignty to a new Iraqi government and withdrawing the troops, and that's not at all clear. And we'll talk about that a little bit more later.
And it also assumes that the attacks on the soldiers are going to decrease now that Saddam's been captured, et cetera, et cetera. And we talked about this a couple weeks ago. I think the whole rationale for not including the numbers into the budget originally up until last year was, we don't know how the war is going to go. Well, we've been there for 9 months now. It's a very clear set of fixed costs to the military at this point. It's a political decision to keep the numbers out of the budget because it would make the budget look that much worse.
Yeah, and the Bush administration can't have it both ways. They can't tell the Iraqi people, we know that you're going to have sovereignty and we're going to pull the troops out. Tell us that they're going to pull the troops out within a certain time frame, and then turn around and tell Congress, we don't know what the costs are going to be because we don't know how the war is going to go. You can't have it both ways.
Yeah, and we see that replicated, that whole process of trying to have it both ways replicated time and time again throughout the budget. You know, making questionable assumptions where, on the one hand, the revenue forecasts are going to be down because of various changes in the tax law that have been put in under the Bush tax cuts, and then saying, well, on the one hand, well, those decreases in revenue are going to be phased out, and on the other hand, saying, well, we're going to try and lobby Congress to make them permanent.
All right, well, let's move along. Weapons of mass destruction moved up to a new level this week. I'm waiting for a headline that says White House admits lack of intelligence. When is that going
to
come?
I'm waiting for George Bush to say he was wrong. I mean, how hard can it be? Because it's obvious to everybody in the country except him, apparently.
Yeah, Richard Pearl had an interesting thing that he said this week. Richard Pearl being the conservative analyst who was behind much of the pressure to use questionable intelligence at the Pentagon. He said, George Bush is a consumer of intelligence, not a producer of it. I think that's very true. I don't think George Bush has produced anything particularly intelligent in the last 3 years, but... Go ahead, Job.
And certainly not a user of intelligence.
Certainly.
No. But it's really been remarkable over the last week or so to have all of these various conservative pundits line up with a line of reasoning that until David Kay showed them a way, they would have dismissed as ludicrous a week and a half ago. And suddenly they're all saying the same thing that the White House is saying. Well, of course the president, he was just acting on the best intelligence available at the time because it's what the intelligence agencies gave him. And so let's name a panel and let's look at the faults of the intelligence agencies. This requires putting on pretty large size 25,000 or so cowboy boots in order to stomp a whole bunch of things down the memory hole. And we don't really have time to go through the whole list, but the whole idea that you have Dick Cheney literally setting up a shadow government, a shadow intelligence agency of his own, the Office of Strategic Planning, that specifically had no other function than to stovepipe information directly up to political decision makers, that was the information they wanted, the information that they could not get out of the intelligence professionals that would justify a war against Iraq. You had much of the information that was used that was then turned out to be fallacious being supplied by exiles from the Iraqi National Congress through contacts with Pearl and with Dick Cheney. They recruited these guys. They foisted these guys off on the intelligence agencies, even when the intelligence agencies in some cases knew that it was unreliable information. There was heavy pressure, unusual pressure on the agencies to produce the information that the political decision makers, the Cheneys and the Bushes, wanted to hear. You know, all of that is forgotten, and now we've got a panel full of hawks, and especially a panel full of people who do not have any background in intelligence matters, who are charged to produce a report, but not before the election. It'll be for next March. And, you know, to take this by the comparison, when the space agency NASA, there was a commission that was convened to investigate the space shuttle disaster a couple of years ago. That panel had people on it whose full-time job was to think about the future of the space agency, to understand some of the technical, you know, the aerodynamic issues and the aerospace issues that are involved with the space shuttle program. You do not have any kind of similar level of expertise or inquiry here. And it's not at all clear so far, because Bush wouldn't take any questions yesterday. It's not at all clear as to what the scope of the commission will be charged to be, because the key question here isn't what intelligence was being produced by the intelligence agencies. The key question here is, where was the White House getting its information? We don't even know that the information that it was using to justify the war against Iraq was coming out of the intelligence agencies. It might have been coming from totally different sources. How was the White House making a decision on which information, which sources of information to use? Did it come from allied countries? Did it come from the intelligence agencies? Were they making it up out of thin air? We just don't know.
OSP, Office of Special Plans, I think is the correct term for that.
Yeah.
Let's move along
But you're correct.
Thank you, sir. Let's move along to This Week in Iraq. Plenty to cover there.
Yeah, there was a lot that happened this week in Iraq. On Tuesday, Brigadier General Mark Kimmett, you know, he's the Deputy Chief of Operations for the U.S. military in Baghdad, told reporters that U.S. troops are coming under attack an average of 23 times per day, every day.
That's per day.
And that means that the level is now up to exactly the same level as it was before Saddam Hussein was captured. That little tidbit I had to find buried deep as the last two or three paragraphs of an Associated Press article, and I haven't seen it reported anywhere in the U.S. media. The other major attack this week involved the twin suicide bombings of the headquarters of the two main Kurdish parties in the Kurdish regional capital of Erbil. Over 100 people were killed and more than 250 were wounded in these attacks. And among the dead were a number of high-ranking Kurdish officials and party leaders. Now, Iraqis are referring to this as the Kurdish September 11th, and they're worried that it's going to signal a rise in ethnic tensions in Iraq, which could lead to civil war. Now, the CIA warned a couple of weeks ago that Iraq is on the verge of and could easily turn into a civil war.
Yeah, this is exactly what they were talking about, this type of violence.
Yes. Now, in spite of the Bush administration's continuing obsession with al-Qaeda, that they've just been assuming, and, you know, George Bush and Dick Cheney go on the air after these kind of attacks happen, and they say, oh, we're sure it was al-Qaeda. Brigadier General Martin Dempsey, that's the guy who's in charge of security for Baghdad, said that the main enemy in Iraq is still the bitter enders. Until 3 days ago, this is a quote from the general, until 3 days ago, we had captured 19 foreigners in Baghdad out of several thousand individuals captured who were former regime loyalists. We are clearly still fighting as the principal enemy, the former regime. Now, of course, he neglects to mention who or what these former regime loyalists are fighting for, given that Saddam Hussein is now out of the picture. In other words, he's not going to mention the fact that a lot of these people are fighting for Iraqi national sovereignty and to drive the U.S. military out of Iraq. Now, it's a good question. How is Iraqi sovereignty faring these days? We've talked on the program the last couple of weeks about the U.S. trying to push for a selection process in Iraq for a new interim legislature.
I'm glad you added in Iraq there.
Yeah, a new selection process in Iraq rather than an election process, which is what the majority Shiite population of Iraq is pushing for. This week, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan finally agreed to send a team to Iraq to try to figure out what the Shiites want. Now, it's
too bad
pretty,
they can't read Arabic, huh?
Yeah, it's pretty clear what the Shiites want. They have said that they want elections. However, the Bush administration does not want to hear that. They want a caucus selection process determined by the people that they choose to decide who will be who will sit on the new interim legislature. Now, that's not what the Shiites will will accept, and Kofi Annan is not willing to go and force it down their and help force it down their throats. So the Bush administration this week has finally shown some signs of giving in on the selection process, and they're saying now that two of the possible solutions might be elections, but the elections can't happen by June 30th. So there's been a little bit of give now on the June 30th deadline.
Now, that's which is totally arbitrary.
Yeah, which was pretty much set by the Bush reelection campaign committee, saying that we got to turn over sovereignty before the election season really heats up in July and August so that Bush has some kind of a victory that he can wave in front of the voters. Now, the alternative, if elections are going to happen in Iraq, is to put them off until December of this year or January of 2005, which again will be after the election campaign here in the United States. Now, in order to do that and to satisfy Bush's reelection campaign committee, the Bush administration is proposing that, as one of their alternatives, that the U.S. turn over sovereignty to an expanded Iraqi governing council. This could be an absolute disaster. An absolute disaster.
It already has been an absolute disaster.
The governing council has been pretty much a disaster from the get-go. It's made up of, for folks who haven't been listening, it's made up of people largely selected by the U.S. Most of them, the people who control the council, are returned exiles. They don't have a good idea of how to run things. They're pretty much incompetent. They've been involved in a lot of factional infighting. They're very corrupt. They've used their power to reward friends, relatives, and business associates with subcontracts for the reconstruction of Iraq. And they just have not done very much to help the Iraqi people who have come to them with problems. Now, Ahmed Chalabi, one of the main exiles on the Iraqi Governing Council, as folks may recall, was convicted of bank fraud in Jordan for stealing millions of dollars from one of the largest banks in the Middle East. He is being accused by some of his critics of using those funds and U.S. taxpayer money to lobby the Pentagon and the Bush administration to support this proposal to expand the Iraqi Governing Council and to make them sort of the interim legislature instead of going through the whole selection process and then allowing elections in 2005, which is basically is just a worse modification of the Bush administration's selection process plan, and the Shiites will not stand for it.
Yeah, I mean, and for people who say here, oh, what caucuses? That's just like here, right? It's the
not.
Same thing. No, we're talking about a very different process. It would be similar if there were a foreign occupying power controlling the state of Washington who was deciding who could and could not participate in the caucuses today, nominating people that were all of their own cronies, and shutting everybody who's listening to this radio show out of the process. Then it might be a little bit more analogous, but it's very, very different than the idea of democracy that is being portrayed to the American people. And the Iraqis know the difference. They're very clear as to what they're asking for. They don't need the UN to tell them.
That's right. Now, in other news in Iraq, the Pentagon is basing its plan to rotate U.S. troops out of Iraq starting in May on a program to train and deploy some 40,000 Iraqi paramilitary troops. Now, this week, the first members of the Iraqi Civil Defense Forces, as they're called, were deployed in Baghdad. The Chicago Tribune sent a reporter to check up and see how they're doing. Now, what the reporter found is that the paramilitaries are operating without radios, bulletproof vests, gasoline, or even a single functioning vehicle. The unit commander said, quote, "Even the pens and paper are from home," end quote. They lack even the most essential thing for a security force in Iraq, which is concrete barriers to protect their new headquarters from suicide car bombers. Now, of course, there's really nothing inside their new headquarters. There's no furniture. There are hardly any phones. The only thing inside the headquarters are Iraqi paramilitary personnel themselves, and as we know, they're meant to be expendable. Now, with the lack of this kind of necessary equipment, they've hardly been able to be effective as a police force on the streets of Baghdad. The number 40,000 itself is a joke, considering if you look at the city of New York, which has some 35,000 police that cover just the metropolitan New York area.
That's just the city limits. That's not the metropolitan area.
I think it is the whole metropolitan area. Yeah. No, it's just the city limits. Yeah. So that makes it even more ridiculous. 40,000 paramilitary are supposed to help police the whole Iraqi nation. Then you can see what kind of a joke this is. And U.S. is not going to be able to pull out its forces on the schedule that the Pentagon has put forth. So.
All right. Anything else on this week in Iraq?
No, let's move on.
All right. Pakistan, if you could briefly touch upon that.
Yeah, there was a big blowout in Pakistan in the last month and in the last week in particular. While the Bush administration has been talking about Iraq and what a threat Iraq was before the war, and now that we found no weapons of mass destruction, Iraq was still a major threat. Pakistan has been hitting the international news. Of course, it hasn't been in the news here in the United States, but in the British press and in the wire services and in the news organizations all over the rest of the world, Pakistan has been the big news as being the worst case of weapons proliferation, particularly nuclear weapons proliferation, to ever come down the pike in the history of the world. Pakistan has been caught selling nuclear weapons to Libya, to North Korea, and to Iran. And the Musharraf government, General Musharraf, the military dictator of Pakistan, has been trying to foist it.
And a good friend of the Bush administration.
Yeah, has been trying to foist it all off on the scientist who leads the nuclear weapons program in Pakistan. But all of the people who know anything about how politics works in Pakistan knows that it's a military dictatorship, has been since independence, and that the military keeps a very, very close control over the factories and the research labs of the nuclear weapons program, that it would be impossible for the equipment and the plans to be shipped abroad without the approval of the Pakistani military. This week, General Musharraf both accused, forced the head of the nuclear weapons program to confess that he had been responsible for the proliferation problem, and then he turned around and pardoned the guy, because to put the man on trial would mean that he would start naming names and pointing fingers at all of the high-ranking members of the Pakistani military, including General Musharraf himself, who would have signed off on these weapons sales. It's a major scandal, and it has not been in the news here at all in the U.S., and that in itself is shocking.
Yeah, and bear in mind that Pakistan was under sanctions from the United States for several years because of its illegal weapons program.
Under the Clinton administration.
Under the Clinton administration. Bush came in, the sanctions were backed off, and with the invasion of Afghanistan, Pakistan has become a major military ally of the United States. So
we are going to give them some $700 million this coming year in aid.
And so suddenly all of the depredations of the military dictatorship there, including this, apparently, are forgiven.
All right, Jav, if you could compress into 2 minutes what happened in Moscow this week.
Yeah, well, I'll make it even quicker than that, but there was a major bombing on the subway system in Moscow, the latest in a steadily escalating series of attacks that's been widely credited to Chechen terrorists. But it's been kind of a remarkable process, because these attacks have gotten a tremendous amount of international media attention because they've targeted civilians in Moscow, but they are a response to the Russian army targeting civilians, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of civilians in Chechnya themselves. But international media does not have any bureaus in Grozny. They have bureaus in Moscow. International media knows who Vladimir Putin is. They don't know who Aslan Maskhadov, who is the president of Chechnya until Russia invaded again in 1999, is. So it's a conflict that has been defined by Russia, enabled by the United States, first with credit to Moscow and more recently with troops in Georgia there, in part because of the Chechen war. And you know, it's going to keep going until the international community clamps down on not on what Chechen quote unquote terrorists are doing in Moscow, but what Russia is doing far away from the limelight in the Caucasus region.
All right, we have been talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State, and perhaps one of you could tell people where the heck you could find Eat the State.
Eat the State can be found in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, and other places around town where you can find free publications. We can also be found on the web at www.eatthestate.org. That's all one word, eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, you want to volunteer, you like or don't like things you hear on this program, you can call and rant and rave at us on our voicemail line, which is 206-903-9461.